And now a conversation between Prairie Public's Doug Hamilton and Alex Bosmoski. Alex is the Director for Strategy and Operations at Republic EN, and he says there's a much better chance of tackling climate change if we get conservatives in a leading role in the conversation. Here's Doug Hamilton.
Alex, tell us about Republic EN. What is it?
RepublicEN.org. We are America's grassroots voice for conservatives concerned about the climate. We are rounding up conservatives, libertarians, Republicans from all across the country who care deeply about climate change, and we're amplifying their voices to correct the misconception around America that conservatives don't care about the issue, and also to inspire conservative leadership in Congress and state houses to take climate change seriously and to look for small government alternative solutions that we haven't seen much discussed as conservatives have sort of stayed silent on the issue.
What drew you to this enterprise? What was your personal journey to accept climate change in your case?
Everyone does seem to have a different personal journey, especially us conservatives, because the tribal orthodoxy can lend the impression that somehow climate change is a world government conspiracy, which is, in fact, sort of how I approached the issue initially when I was a youngster, having been impressed, having read and been impressionable with conservative talk radio and conservative punditry. And I was certainly under the impression that this was an overblown issue when I first approached it. But after or during the process of taking climate science classes at Georgetown and then at Oxford, I started to see some holes in the way that conservatives were thinking about it. Initially, actually, the first climate science course I ever took at Georgetown, I signed up basically to heckle the professor. I thought to myself, well, this will be fun. You know, a liberal professor, I enjoyed and had fun being the devil's advocate in government classes and policy classes, so why not in a science class? But that whole experience turned out to be really eye-opening, because when you go search for actual evidence to back up, you know, some of the crazy claims out there that CO2 isn't a pollutant, or that it's not warming, or that somehow warming would be good, or the other one is, if we do anything about it, you know, it won't matter. When you approach those looking for scientific justifications, you can't find them. So I started to feel pretty alienated from my tribe and was looking for, where are the serious conservatives who are seriously thinking about how to solve climate change?
Well, if our listeners want to follow up on this, it's republicen.org. That's the website where all of this is laid out, and where I discovered that your executive director, Bob Inglis, a former South Carolina Republican congressman, he lost his House seat in 2010 by introducing a bill to tax carbon emissions. I mean, that was part of the loss, I assume.
It was part of it, you know. During the midst of the Great Recession, when you are a frontiersman out there on the in front of an issue and you're telling your constituents that it's time to lead, and it can come as quite a shock to people who are struggling to make their next mortgage payment and to whom climate change can feel like a distant, far-off issue. And, you know, Bob would say, note to self, don't introduce a carbon tax during the height of the Great Recession. But thank God he did. Thank God that Bob Inglis and Jeff Flake stood up and said, look, this is the conservative small government solution, and we know we're going to get arrows in the back for this, but someone's got to be first. And Bob was first, and now we're out there trying to start a movement. So, you know, it's a bummer that the primary voters ousted him, but I'm also grateful that that happened, because now we have, you know, a real leader who has the credibility and the experience to go try to start this movement. So I'm really happy about that.
How did climate change become such a divisive issue, Alex?
That's a great question. It's such a shame that it has become such a divisive issue. And most of the division you find between the fringe right and the fringe left. Over the last generation, the environmental left has all but had a monopoly over the climate change issue. And if you went down the street, walked down the street and asked, you know, the first 10 people you saw, who's the first person you think of when you think of climate change? You're probably going to get like 9 Al Gores. And maybe you'll get 1 Elon Musk from a dude in the Tesla. But climate change has come to be associated with the environmental left. And because the environmental left has often seen climate change as a pretense for accomplishing a lot of other objectives on the left, like income redistribution, shrinking inequality, centralizing control of the energy market in the federal bureaucracy. These are really anathema to conservatives who appreciate and value small government and subsidiarity and empowering local communities to deal with problems. So I think over a generation of hearing, you know, more liberal-leaning people expound on the urgency of climate change and follow it with a big government solution, that conservatives have often taken to, you know, hoaxerism or denial as more of a coping mechanism than a governing strategy. But because if you're presented with a problem and the only solution is one that really doesn't fit with your values, then it's really easy just to belittle, poo-poo the problem. What we're trying to do is to show all Americans that dealing with climate change doesn't have to be about sacrifice. It doesn't have to be about, you know, everyone carpooling to their, you know, job at the kayak shop or whatever, and, you know, a windmill on every street corner and a solar panel on every roof. That feels like what the solution is if you concede to the urgency of climate change. But that's not the case. You know, and that's what we're really trying to convey. And when you find conservatives out there that care about climate and they feel uncomfortable with the way the left talks about it, that's exactly why we exist, because this is an issue too great and too urgent to leave to just one side of the political aisle. Our country really works best when you have competition of ideas. So we think there's a much better chance that we can actually tackle climate change if you get conservatives in the conversation, in a leading role in the conversation.
Well, your side of the political aisle is the one that is in power right now, and the president himself has called climate change a hoax, along with his chief political strategist, Steve Bannon, a hoax. So there's some work to be done inside that party, isn't there?
Yeah, firing Steve Bannon, probably. But, you know, there are also really terrific voices within the administration that give me hope that the administration could pivot to a leadership posture on climate change. And I can think of some scenarios where that might be possible. And just for a couple examples, the Secretary of State has, while CEO of ExxonMobil, been a vocal advocate for a revenue-neutral carbon tax, as has President Trump's recently named chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, Kevin Hassett, who is continuing a rich tradition of Republican chief economists supporting a revenue-neutral carbon tax. Also, in his administration, General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, has had statements on how important climate risk is to military planning and our national security at home and abroad. And the other thing I'd say is the president is now in charge of the greatest scientific research establishment on the face of the earth. He regularly hears from scientists who work for the federal government, the executive branch of the federal government. He hears NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration scientists. He hears from NASA scientists, and he hears from the Pentagon, not to mention the National Academy of Sciences and all of the wonderful scientists that work at the Department of Energy, Department of Agriculture. All of these people work for President Trump. And the reality of governing, I hope, sinks in. And as these wonderful scientists, the best that we've got in America, continue to brief the president on the risks facing his people, I would expect to see some leadership on this eventually.
Well,
I hope that we can make it soon.
We certainly heard a lot about coal during the campaign, and we've heard a lot about it since the president has taken office. But there's a truth about coal that's a little bit difficult in terms of it growing hugely or employing a lot more people. And isn't the truth kind of important here?
Boy, you couldn't. That is completely true, and it is. It frustrates me every day, this narrative that we're bringing coal back by unraveling the Environmental Protection Agency. It was an easy line when you're in the minority to say to all your constituents that are affected by coal country, or that it's the big bad EPA and the big bad Obama who are retaking all your jobs. And if we just get them out of office and we downsize the EPA, then all your coal jobs are going to come back. And President Trump said that out of one side of his mouth, and then on the other side of his mouth, he'd go up to North Dakota and talk about how great fracking is and how great we have to protect the frackers and the natural gas revolution in America. And I totally agree with that second part, but if the president was really serious about bringing back coal jobs, he'd be taking aim at the efficiency of fracking in places like North Dakota. The truth is natural gas and automation are taking away coal jobs. And the only future for coal in this country is if we can figure out a way to burn it without contributing to climate change.
Well, let's talk about this idea that you mentioned previously, this revenue neutral carbon tax. This seems to be a marketplace idea, conservative idea, that doesn't require necessarily some kind of new infrastructure, solar panels everywhere or windmills everywhere, but literally a tax on people who generate carbon. How does it work?
A carbon tax would work by putting the cost of pollution onto the fuels that cause the pollution. So fossil fuels would become accountable for some of the costs that they're currently spreading across society. As it stands, you burn coal, you effectively get to socialize your costs. You get to privatize your profits, but you get to socialize your costs. And again, and no one is consenting to paying those costs, but you pay them at the hospital and your insurance premiums. You pay them with, the impacts of climate change. So a carbon tax attaches some of those costs to the price of the fuels. And what that does is it sends a price signal, which is something that we love as conservatives. It sends a price signal into the market that rewards innovating around pollution. It gives the challenger fuels the ability to compete on a level playing field with incumbent fuels that currently don't pay for their pollution. So as a conservative, the other thing that a carbon tax lets you accomplish, which we find to be really exciting, is it doesn't require an expansive bureaucratic state to monitor and administer the decisions of individual people or individual companies or even individual states. That's typically been the approach adopted by more liberal environmentalists, that centralizing the control over the energy market in the federal government and empowering technocrats to administer expert rules that decide for us how much pollution a particular power plant should emit or how much pollution a particular state or sector should emit. And a carbon tax takes all of that government intervention off the table. It also renders redundant these subsidies that we currently pay to clean energy. It's our way of catching up clean energy to the polluting industries. We basically subsidize both sides of the equation in the country. We subsidize fossil fuels with direct subsidies and with free pollution, and then we subsidize the renewable energies that compete with those fossil fuels. So a carbon tax is pretty much the only way you can clear the deck here, get rid of all these subsidies, and then companies can compete for customers instead of competing for political patronage.
But somebody has to set the tax.
Indeed. Someone has to set the tax. It's a tough question exactly what it should be and what the schedule should be over time, but it's an ethical question. It's one that this is why we send representatives to Congress. To set that tax, you got to ask yourself really important questions, like how much we value human lives, how much we value wilderness, how much we value, you know, how risk averse are we to potential impacts in coastal areas around the country? These are really tough questions. But I'd say that to start, the most important question is, or the most important thing is to set a tax that rises over time and the revenue of which is used completely for tax reductions in other areas. Maybe I can explain that just a little bit better. Currently, we tax income, jobs, labor, investment, and all of us can agree that those are really good things, and we want more of those things. But we don't tax pollution, and we want less pollution. Even if you're out there thinking, I'm not sure that this climate change thing is a really big deal, you can agree that we probably want less pollution, and we definitely want more income. So if you set a tax that rises slightly over time, you're sending that price signal through the market to get innovation, and you're also raising the revenue that we need to cut taxes on income and productivity.
Could you give us a vision for our country, our planet, in 10 years? What changes do you expect to see?
Ooh, I'd like to see America reclaim the mantle of leadership on this very important issue that touches every part of our lives. I'm not saying that climate change is the only or the most important issue that America needs to lead on, but this affects the whole world. And when you have mass migrations out of, for example, Bangladesh into two different nuclear-armed countries that are not friendly, Pakistan, China, and India, not friendly with each other. And you have, you know, a million climate refugees flooding across the border. That has real security implications for America and real diplomacy and, like, livelihood impacts on all three of those countries. So I would like to see America reclaim the mantle of leadership. And it is really important to think, it's not our job as Americans to solve climate change for the whole world. That's not our job. And it's very true that China, India, Brazil, Mexico, South Korea, Indonesia, these countries, it's incredibly important that America works with these countries to reduce emissions around the world and to share technologies that make that possible. But really, this works so much better with America leading the way. You don't get global meaningful action without American leadership. And you don't get American leadership without bipartisan coalitions. And right now, we don't have a bipartisan coalition because Republicans aren't playing ball. And Republicans aren't going to play ball until they hear that their constituents, especially their conservative constituents, care about solving climate change.
Alex Bosmoski is Director of Strategy and Operations for Republic EN. You can find out more at republicen.org. Thank you for spending some time with us today, Alex.
Thank you for having me.